Okay, so last talk of the conference, a workshop. I'm going to try to make it a nice one. So I first of all have to thank Neil and Stefan for the opportunity to speak. For those of you who don't know, I did my PhD here with Latham, so it's very nice to be back and speaking in front of a friendly audience who I know many of. And for those who remember me, you'll know that I usually in the past have spoken about completely different things to this. But I promise you, this really will be a talk on cosmology. And the one to blame really for this is Stefan, because some time ago he came to the Max Planck and gave a very nice talk on his work with Neil. And it interests me to the point that I started doing a project on non-singular bounces. So you can blame Stefan. But okay, so this is a joint work with Jean-Luc Lenners and Tao Tao Kui on spinner-driven cosmic bounces and their instability. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start by first of all giving a little bit of a cartoon about what it is that we're interested in. And then after that, I'm going to go ahead and fill in the details. The idea, of course, is to make it accessible to everyone in the room. So if there's anything I'm saying that doesn't make any sense, or if I'm going too fast or whatnot, please just stop me or ask questions or that sort of thing. All right, so what is the cartoon? We're interested in theories of gravity with torsion, where the torsion is non-dynamical and sourced by spinners, Dirac spinners. Okay? Now, the picture is that in most circumstances, we recover regular Einstein-Hilbert gravity, right? Because the torsion is non-dynamical, it only becomes relevant in regions where the spinner density is high. So this is the cartoon. The universe is in a contracting phase, and as the scale factor drops, the spinner density increases until it eventually precipitates a bounce, right, at some finite value. So that's the cartoon, and there's already some previous literature on these ideas, and the claim is that these models are stable, right, but no one's checked. So what I'm going to show you is that is not true. So that's the cartoon of the talk, and now I'm going to go ahead and try to fill in those details as best I can.
Okay. So this is just really classical gravity with torsion and
yeah.
And the spinner,
yes.
And spinner field.
Completely classical. Okay, so just to give a little bit of an outline, I'm going to start with an introduction. I'll give a little bit more motivation, right, and then I'm going to give a few preliminaries. I'm just going to remind people what torsion is and just outline some notation, because I'm going to be using it in many of the equations that follow. And I'll try to make that as quick as possible so that I don't bore people who probably know it better than me. And then I'll jump into dynamics. So I'll outline what my model is, what the model of interest is. I'll show you the action that we're going to be using. And then, because this is something that I doubt many people have done in the room, I'm going to make a few comments about deriving the equations of motion. Right? Because most cosmologists, I guess, play around with scalar fields, but not spinorial matter. Okay, so after that, after I've introduced the dynamics, I'm going to introduce some background cosmologies. So I'm going to look at background solutions which undergo bounces, right? And I'm also going to try to incorporate some interesting dynamics either side of the bounce. I'm going to focus on ekpyrotic models. Well, an ekpyrotic model. And after that, once I've introduced that sort of background material, I'm going to jump into the discussion of stability. I'm going to look at the linearized equations, and the goal will be to construct an equation for the co-moving curvature perturbation, and then have a look at its dynamics as it goes through the bounds. Right? And then finally, I'll conclude with a few remarks, and then try to address some of the questions that were raised by the organizers of the workshop. So that's the goal. So let's begin. Why a bounce and why spinners? I don't really need to give much motivation in this room, but just to say a few words. In the standard cosmological picture, we begin with the cosmological singularity, you know, a point at which the usual rules in physics break down, right? Our usual description breaks down. And that's not a very good place to start, right? What you'd like is a theory of initial conditions, as was discussed by Jean-Luc, to some extent, or either a bounce, right? And so in this talk, I'm interested in a bounce, a classical bounce that occurs at a finite value for the scale factor. And as was pointed out by Robert, this is a nice thing to consider because it offers a tantalizing possibility of solving some of the standard cosmological problems outside the framework of inflation. Although you could also involve inflation. Okay. So without giving any more motivation, I'll say that I'm either going to have to modify my theory of gravity or introduce some sort of matter which violates the null energy condition. Right? And so usually that would be a scalar field which undergoes some ghost condensation or Galileans. In this model, I'm going to look at spinners coupled to torsion. Right? This is my exotic matter. Now, these models like this have been studied in some detail, and here are some of the references if you're interested. And there's a little bit of lore that seems to go along with these papers. People claim that these models are stable. Right? What the idea, or what they say, is that because the torsion is non-dynamical, and the operators which lead to the bounce, well, to the violation of the non-energy condition, are associated to that torsion, right, which has no kinetic terms, you won't get gradient or ghost instabilities. Right? That's the picture that they try to peddle, but then no one has actually checked. Okay, so that's the reason why this is interesting, because these models are supposed to be stable.
How certain is it that you need to violate the null energy condition? I mean, there are bouncing-like things that don't violate the null energy condition. De Sitter, for example.
I gave another example. You could change your theory of gravity as well.
Yeah, you could do that, but I'm just asking, if you don't do that, why do you say that you must violate the null energy condition?
If you don't have spatial De Sitter exploits double.
If you don't have spatial curves, so if you want the spatial metric to be flat.
It's only
fast. Okay. And we don't know if.
All right, so the preliminaries. Just to remind people, so in differential geometry, the covariant derivative is not unique because we can always add a tensor to the connection, right? And so what we do in general relativity is we add two assumptions in order to get to a unique connection. So we add the assumption of metric compatibility and torsion freedom, which states that these lower two indices here are symmetric. Then these assumptions are strong enough that you can obtain this usual Christoffel symbol that we're familiar with. The context I'm going to work in is one in which we drop this second assumption. So we're removing an assumption. And when you do that, you get a more general form for the connection. You get the appearance of this contortion tensor here, which you can express in terms of the anti-symmetric part of the connection, or the torsion, right? So this is the framework within which we're working. Right? And then just a quick slide to highlight some notation that's going to be popping up again and again and again. So I'm going to be using the language of forms. So here is a covariant exterior derivative acting on a spinner, psi. And I use, the notation is pretty standard. So I have my Fierbein, my spin connection, and also my gamma matrices here. Wherever I choose a basis for my spinners, I'm going to choose the Senn and Weil basis. And another thing to point out is I'll often want to write my equations in contortion-free form. So I can split up my spin. I often split up my spin connection into a torsion-free part and a torsion-full part, I guess. And then I use the standard notation for the torsion-2 form. All right. With that notation in play, let me introduce the actual models of interest. All right, so I'm going to split up my action into a gravitational part and a matter sector. Now, the idea is that I want to explore, I want to understand the effect that torsion has on the gravitational dynamics. And so I want to start by writing down the most general gravitational action I can think of. Right, and there's a very nice paper by Laurent and his collaborators where he uses an effective field theory approach where he takes certain assumptions. So he wants an action which is generally covariant and locally Lorentz invariant, and constructs polynomial and the basic field continents derivatives. And when you do this, you only really have, to lowest order, six possible terms that you can write down. Three of which are topological, which I'm going to ignore, and one which is the cosmological constant term, which I'm going to include in my matter action. And then the only thing that remains are these two terms. So there's the standard Einstein-Hilbert term, which you'll all be familiar with. There's also this additional Hulse term, and just as an aside, this coupling here is known as the Imerizzi-Pack parameter for anyone with interest. So this Hulse term is usually zero in theories of gravity without torsion because of the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. So it's identically zero in the cases that you're probably most familiar with. Since I'm anticipating the addition of spinorial matter or fermions into my model, I'm also writing this in first order form, but it's not necessary for those who are more comfortable with the usual second order formalism. We once again get the Einstein-Hilbert term and a Hulse term. Okay. Now, I need to add some matter to source the torsion, and so I'm going to add the matter sector, the fermionic action. If you remember in my introduction, I mentioned there are a bunch of papers on these models which claim stability, right? And they all have a slightly different action. So if you go ahead and you turn off any of these couplings here in various combinations, you'll obtain the various papers who claim stability. Right? I think this is the most general action you can write down with couplings between the vector and axial currents and the torsion, right? Where I'm using the standard notation for the vector and axial terms. All right, so we have a kinetic term, my couplings between the various spinor currents and my torsion, and I'm also going to allow for potential terms, which could include a cosmological constant or a mass term for the spinor, basically functions of the spinor density, psi bar psi. Okay. All right, so I'm not going to go in full detail and show you the complete derivation of the equations of motion or anything like that, because it's quite frankly horrible. But I will show you the result. So deriving the equations of motion for these models is not too hard as long as you turn off all of these couplings, alpha, beta, tau, and lambda. But if you have them turned on, life gets a lot more tricky. In any case, what we'll do is we'll vary the action with respect to our fundamental fields, which will be our spin connection, our Fierbein, and our spinor. So first off, I'll start by varying with respect to the spin connection. And you, after not too long a calculation, you obtain this rather opaque equation, which doesn't look too useful. But what you can do is you can solve it for the contortion. And you get the following after a pretty horrendous calculation. So at the beginning of my talk, I said that the torsion was non-dynamical, and this is what I mean. So here I have an algebraic expression for the contortion written in terms of these spinor currents. So if you remember on the previous slide, I introduced this these spinor currents here. So this omega and this theta, they're just a convenient way to express this equation. So the nice thing is, as I go forward, I'll also get very disgusting equations for Dirac and Einstein equations. But once I use this algebraic expression for the contortion, everything sort of tightens up and becomes a lot nicer. Okay, so let's do that. So varying with respect to the spinor, this is our Dirac equation. It looks...
If you were to require parity to be a good symmetry, would it rule out that term?
No, it wouldn't. I'm going to talk about that in a second.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to be looking at parity invariant backgrounds at some point. One thing you just reminded me is a good thing to mention is, see, notice that if I had removed my spinors from my theory, then each of these terms here would be identically zero, and my contortion would vanish, and I'd just return to regular Einstein-Hilbert gravity, right? That's something...
Is it essential kind of... Would you also do it with chiral spinors, or is it... does the story change much, or is it the
same? So I'm working here with Dirac spinners. Right. I haven't looked specifically at that case, but I don't know. Yeah, I should have mentioned this is for I'm looking at Dirac spinners.
You're allowing both the axial and vector currents. So
yes.
By taking the proper combination, you're also including.
Right.
Yeah, so things will be.
Okay, so there's our horrible Dirac equation. We can substitute in for the contortion and obtain a torsion. So just to remind you, these tildes indicate that this is a torsion-free term, right? So separated my spin connection. So you can write the Dirac equation in this rather compact form, where W here is an effective potential, written in terms of our original potential, you know, action, and then in terms of these sort of quartic terms in the spinners. Right? So these are like four-point interactions. And finally, we can vary the action with respect to the Fierbein. And once again, a disgusting equation, but it can be cleaned up with the sort of calculation that you really should only do in privacy. So I just want to mention one interesting thing, and this is something that, I knew nothing about this, so I figure many people in the room won't know about this as well. But if you do this, you get an unusual term, I didn't expect it, which seems unusual because it's not symmetric in mu and nu, which seems problematic because the Einstein tensor is, and so is this term, and so is the metric as far as I know. But what happens is that if you can see that it's identically zero on shell. So if I make use of the Dirac equation, this term dies. Okay. And I'm just using this compact notation here for this type of term. Right. So just putting it all together, here are our equations of motion written in contortion free form. Okay, this is a nice spot to stop. Any questions? Was it something unclear?
What were the black dots?
Where do I have?
Just to show where the index goes.
Yeah,
because there's so many.
Yeah. I knew that I was going to come back to this at the end of the day and just be completely confused about where indices were, and I didn't want to leave a blank space. Maybe you don't need to do it anyway.
Again, doesn't this immunity parameter in itself, that term violate parity invariance? So then you're saying you look at parity invariant backgrounds, but the theory itself,
what I mean by that,
regarded as a theory.
What I mean by that is I look at spinners which satisfy the equation gamma zero psi equals psi.
Right.
But I think it's true, the theory itself has this parity.
The paper I mentioned by Laurent actually covers this in some detail, but I haven't read it in detail. It's nice though. Okay, anyone else? Now's your chance.
Okay, I'll ask one. Supergravity is a special case of this.
This isn't a supersymmetric theory.
No, but supergravity has the same ingredients.
Right. We were actually curious about this to see whether.
You need spin 3 here.
Yeah, we were interested.
Yeah, sure. But if you set it to zero, then it should be a special case of this. I just wondered if there was anything.
Well. Jean-Luc actually had a nice idea, which was, I don't know much about supergravity, but you know, you always get this three halves particle, and we were wondering if you could get similar bounces using that field.
You can.
You can? Oh, it's lucky we didn't do a program. Sorry?
I did it in 1989. But you can, it's generic. That is, you have to choose models, some bounce, some. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a look at constructing background solutions. And so I have to make a few assumptions The first one, I hope no one really has a problem with. I'm going to look at flat FRW backgrounds. So here's my line element written in conformal time. The second of my assumptions is the same assumption that's taken in all the papers that I mentioned previously, but it's one that, just in the spirit of full declaration, it's the one that people might have the most problems with. Right? But so basically what we want to do is we want to consider our equations of motion as being operator equations, right? And then we want to view the observed classical gravitational field as being sourced by the values of spinor invariants, such as the sidebar, there should be a bar up there, so such as the spinor density. And so what we're going to do is we define what's known as a classical spinor, right? It's the expectation value of this operator psi in a particular state such that this condition is satisfied. Right? What that means in practice, for the actual calculation, is that we can view the spinor as a four-component object where the entries are classical complex numbers, such that this sits in the representation Lorentz group and satisfies the Dirac equation. Right? So it's perfectly mathematically consistent, and you can view it sort of in the same way that you might view the scalar inflaton as an effective description of some underlying fundamental physics. Right? It's just that here our field obeys a different equation of motion. So anyway, this is...
What does that problem
look like?
Box
space.
So...
I'm just thinking, you know, this is supposed to be fermion, so...
Yeah, so this actually places pretty severe restrictions on... So there's a nice paper by Picon and Green when they basically discuss what circumstances this assumption holds. And I forget exactly what the conditions are, but they provide a situation in which it could be realistic to consider these. For the purpose of this talk, I'm just taking it as a given that I'm working with a classical spinner. Yep. Okay. But
I was worried about this too. If you just say psi bar psi has an expectation value, there's nothing shocking about that. But now you've said more. You've said
There's a reason for this.
It's more.
There's
or
a
less
reason for this.
Just the square of the expectation value of psi itself. That's.
There's a reason for this. There's an ambiguity in going from the first order formalism to the second order formalism.
Yeah.
Right. Because you know, in the first order formalism, you might have something that looks like this, and then you know. Do you take the expectation value, you know? Do you take the expectation value around, you know, the quantity psi bar psi, or around psi bar? You know, there's this ambiguity, and so to remove that ambiguity, we're adding this additional condition.
Would your theory work if you were to set? It sounds like it would not work if you were to set the expectation value of psi itself to zero.
No.
Is that right?
You'd
lose the bounds.
Yeah. You lose the bounds.
So what if someone were to say, I don't know who it would be.
It could be you.
But I wouldn't say that. Someone were to say that a classical spinor field is a Grassmann-valued object.
These are not Grassmann-valued.
Yeah, I know. So these are, and what Neil was saying, I mean, how can there be a condensate of fermions?
Right, because of the exclusion principle.
There could be a condensate
principle
of Cooper pairs or something, but how would you have a condensate of?
Yeah. So this is obstructive, of course. As I said, there's this nice paper by Picon and Green where they discuss circumstances in which this condition might be realistic. But I'm just viewing it as a description, you know, an effective description of some underlying physics. And then seeing whether or not it makes sense at the end of the day. And it appears as though, well, these models are unstable. So this might be, I mean, this would be a place where you'd attack, right?
If states exist, then you say, take that state in a box space if somebody shows this to me.
Right.
It could be that Wigley zero may be a problem, is to exactly what that approximation is.
Right. Okay, so I want to just point out that once you've made this assumption, it simplifies your life quite a lot, right? What you can do is, if you're lazy, you can just, or if you just want to do it brute force, you can just plug in and you'll see that this these identities hold exactly, where E is, I'm just gonna use this notation, where E is my spin density and B is this term here. This is an axial scalar. Well, I'm not sure what you'd call this, but okay, so what's nice about this is that the effective potential I mentioned earlier simplifies dramatically, right? And takes this following form, right? Where this coupling here is written in terms of the original couplings in my action, right? The ones in front of the axial and vector source terms. Now, I just want to point out one thing, and people that have been paying attention might raise another objection, which is that the axial current seems to pick out a preferred space-like direction, right? So it seems as though my two assumptions are incompatible with one another, right? And there's a very nice paper by Isham and Nielsen where they discuss this, and they show, indeed, if I take an FRW background, that's usually incompatible with the classical spinner assumption, except for flat FRW, right? There's no obstruction there. For flat FRW, all the equations of motion are consistent with one another, and you can do it. And so this is the case that we're looking at, flat FRW.
So would it be possible to just take the first two equations to replace the previous condition on this expectation value splitting? Because that might be a bit cleaner conceptually.
Right. It might be equivalent though. I haven't actually checked. Yeah, I mean, that would be a good way to relax your conditions.
Yeah, you only have the bilinears. You only have the E and the
right.
B. You don't worry about the individual ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a good idea. Yeah. I haven't considered that. Yeah.
What was the definition of A, capital A again?
So...
it's the axial current.
Yeah.
So it's a bilinear. So.
Yeah, so it's these terms.
Right.
Okay. All right, so...
explain this comment that it's consistent with flat FRW.
Yes, so what I mean by that... Yeah. So what I mean by that is, I've actually gone and done this. You take the equations of motion, take both assumptions, and you check, and what you'll run into is inconsistencies. You end up with an equation which essentially forces you to set the axial current to zero. Yeah. But that doesn't happen in the flat case.
There's, so cancellation.
It just the diffeomorphism constraint is actually zero. In other words, it's in the right-hand side that you would get from the diffeomorphism constraint. That's Nelson, right?
Isherman, is that pronounced Isham? Isham and Nelson, yeah. That's also a very nice. There's a bunch of nice papers. It's a pity these models are unstable. So with these,
do you also have a sort of Kasner-like solution?
What do you mean by that?
Ones which are homogeneous but anisotropic.
Oh yeah.
That suggested. They could be, for example.
Yeah. So yeah.
Standing along the.
Yeah, their paper doesn't.
Digital direction contracting along.
Yeah, so their paper doesn't disqualify Kasner type solutions, yeah. As far as I know. Given these two assumptions, the equations of motion simplify quite a lot. I just want to mention one thing. If you look at on the right hand side of the Einstein equation, right, the stress energy tensor is written completely in terms of spinner bilinears. And so it's nice to also express the Dirac operator in a similar way. And you can do that. So you can express the Dirac equation in projected form, and when you do that, this is what you get. So this is a closed set of equations, which you can solve numerically, right? But we can also look at restricted cases and solve analytically. So I'm gonna impose the condition that Raphael asked about. I'm gonna impose this parity invariance condition. And in the literature, it's known as the ambidextrous spinner. So when you do that, the equations of motion simplify quite a lot, and you get this expression here for the Dirac equation, which you can solve directly, right? And you see that the spinner density grows monotonically as the scale factor drops, which is what we wanted to start with. And what's nice about this is this doesn't depend on that potential U that we chose at the beginning in our action. Right? That's not the case for the Einstein equation. It does depend on that potential. Right, so I can't solve this equation directly without choosing a potential. So just to give you some examples, I'm going to start by considering a mass term for the spinner. Right? And when you do that, you can solve analytically. And this was done by Kibble and his collaborators, Magaja and Tom Slosnick, who was here at some point. Anyway, they find this particular solution analytically, and this solution goes through a bounce rather generically as long as the mass term is positive and this coupling here is negative. So just to show you, here's this particular solution for a chosen set of parameters. And we can also look at the equation of state, and you see far away from the bounce, it goes to zero. And then as you approach the bounce, it becomes negative and quite large. So that's quite nice, because our potential that we chose is very simple. Almost the simplest thing you can write down, just about. But it would be nice if we could also obtain favorable dynamics, right? We want to make sure that our models aren't overcome by anisotropies. And so it's nice, especially in this room, to consider parabolic models. And so I want to consider the following potential. And I'm choosing this potential for a very special reason. It's because I can solve the equations of motion analytically, right? For potentials of this form, right? And you obtain a bounce as long as this coupling is positive and this one is negative. So in this case, for this potential, the equation of state can be written as follows. And we know that as the scale factor increases, the spinner density drops monotonically, it decreases. And so far away from the bounce, if you look at this carefully, you'll see that the equation of state goes to n minus 1, where n is an integer here in this equation. So as long as we choose n to be equal to or greater than 3, we should expect an ekparadic model. And so,
2.
Oh, sorry?
Bigger or equal than 2.
Bigger or equal to 3. Is it?
4.
No, because I want it to be strictly greater than 1, the equation of state, far away from the bounds, right?
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. So
you don't want it to be asymptotically ekparadic.
Right, yeah. Otherwise, I would have just, I could have.
Sorry.
Yeah, what I could have done, that's a good case. If I wanted to do that, then I could have just set this term here to 0 and just chosen this to be 4. And I would have obtained this borderline case. Yeah, I wouldn't have needed this. Anyway. So I'm choosing this particular form because it's nice analytically, but you can consider more general forms as well. So here's the solution. You once again get a bounce, right? And this is again for a particular choice of parameters. And then you can see the equation of state. It behaves as we would have expected. Okay, so once again, question intermission. If there's, I guess people are tired. But how much time do I have? 15 minutes.
Yeah, almost.
Really?
The next talk starts at 4, so we have to be in. Yeah, Neil, I guess we have to be in Skyrim at 4, right?
We're supposed to be in Skyrim at 4.
Yeah,
but
we can postpone the coffee break until after we're in Skyrim for a few minutes, right? That would make sense. Because we haven't done the coffee break.
Let's go directly. Why don't we just tell Stephanie to come here? And then we'll go and have coffee.
Yes, that might be easier, actually. Yes, they're very practical.
In any case, I'll try to be...
There's a break
in 4.
This is all recorded as well. So
no, it's all been cut out.
For posterity.
It'll be edited.
That was a good question. It spurred some discussion. All right, so the next thing I want to do is look at my linearized equations. So I'm going to perturb about my background solutions I've just shown you. And so here's my line element. I gauge fix because it's just simpler to look at the equations in a fixed gauge. So my Fierbein have 10 parameters, and I can soak up 6 of them with my local Lorentz symmetry. And I can gobble up 2 of my scalar degrees of freedom and 2 vector degrees of freedom using my coordinate invariance. So this is my gauge fixed line element. I'm also going to perturb about the solution for the spinner. Okay, unlike for the background case, I'm not going to write down the full set of equations in linear order. They're not too bad, it's just they're too big. And I just want to show you this 0-0 component of the Einstein equations for one reason, because it sort of highlights a problem that arose that we really didn't expect at the beginning of this calculation. And that is that we get mixing between scalar, vector, and tensor modes, right? It's something that confused us for some time, and when we had some discussions with Latham and various other people, and now we think we understand what's going on. So the usual decomposition theorem relies on the symmetries of the background. And in particular, it depends on the fact that you have no relevant quantities which you can form at the background level, which violate that symmetry. Right? And if you remember at the start of my talk, once we invoked the classical spinner assumption, we have this axial vector which picks out a preferred direction. So we have this background quantity with a free index that we can then contract on vector quantities or on tensor quantities. In fact, that's what's happening, right? We get these unusual mixing terms between this vector perturbation and this background quantity here. And it's not obstructive, it just makes the story much more difficult, right? And there are other difficulties that arise. So so that's just a nice surprise that we had halfway through the calculation.
I mean, you're only focusing on the metric, but on the other hand, you're propagating spinners, and therefore should you not have really considered perturbations of the tetrads?
I haven't shown it here, but I do perturb the tetrads, and yeah, I haven't. The reason why I didn't show that was because the various degrees of freedom that are floating around in the equations are all present in the line element. And I just don't want to confuse people, but yes, we're perturbing everything.
And these are an inhomogeneous perturbation you're looking at.
Mm. Right, there's spatial dependence. Just to remind everyone of what the goal is, because you know, you've been sitting there for a little bit. We want to look at gauge invariant quantities like the co-moving curvature perturbation. All right, so at the end of the day, we want to construct an equation of motion for it. And it's kind of helpful if we first of all express the equation's motion in real fluid form. It just makes our life easier. And so that's what we can do. And it works out. So you can write the equations of motion in this real fluid form. We've got P and rho in this anisotropic stress term, which satisfies the usual conditions. Now, you don't need to memorize anything on the screen at the moment. I'm just putting it up for completeness. And also just to point out that these mixing terms occur between scalars and vectors, vectors and tensors, right? They continue to occur in all the equations, right? And if you look at the scalar component, part of the anisotropic stress, another surprise which was lovely is that it's typically non-zero. So that's something else that makes our life a little bit more difficult. But again, we can get around the obstruction. So here are the equations of motion written in standard form, scalar equations of motion, right? And the goal is, and this is what we want to get to, we want to construct an equation for the co-moving curvature perturbation, right? Which is written in terms of this Q. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to make some restrictions, because solving the equations of motion in general form is quite tricky. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to restrict, just as I restricted the background of the parity invariant case, I'm going to look at parity invariant perturbations. And the idea is if I can show that those are unstable, then, I mean, you're done, right? So that's what I'm going to do. And I'm going to also look at the special case where the potential is given by just this mass term. So that's the first model I showed you on the screen, the first model we went through. So what I can do is I can differentiate this equation twice, right? And then I can use these equations of motion to massage into the following form. And people who have done this equation, this calculation in the scalar case, might be confused that it looks like there's no k dependence. And you'd be right. And so you can actually understand why this occurs. And that is, so we're making parity invariant, we're looking at parity invariant spinners, right? And if you look at the kinetic term in the action, your partial derivatives always contract on a gamma matrix, right? And so for parity invariant spinners, if you look at a bilinear, any bilinears which sandwich an odd number of spatial gamma matrices go to zero, right? And so basically all the terms, that's a large reason why this term turns off for the approximation, for the particular perturbations that we're looking at. Okay, so anyway, this equation is also interesting for another reason, and that is that this coefficient theta is singular in three different places. Right? So I plot it here. Right? It becomes singular as the null energy condition is violated, at the bounce itself, and again when the null energy condition stops being violated. Right? But just because the equations of motion are singular doesn't mean that the solutions are. Right? So, for example, we can find this solution r dot equals zero, so some constant r. Right? But the point is, if we have some growing solution, it will tend to dominate. Right? So, we want to see if we can obtain finite solutions. Right? So what do we need to? What does r need to satisfy it, if it's going to be a finite solution? Well. R dot needs to be zero at the points where theta becomes singular. Right? And so let's consider the case here where r is decreasing, so r dot is less than one. What we require is that r double dot is greater than, is positive, sorry. If r dot is negative, then we require r double dot to be positive, to the left of. I should tell you what's actually being shown here. So this is along this axis is the time, this is r, and then this is the point at which theta becomes singular. Right? So if r dot is less than zero, then in order to obtain r dot equals to zero at the singular point, then r double dot has to be greater than zero. And the opposite is true on this side. Right? So you can convince yourself over here they have to be opposite sign, and over here they have to be the same sign. Right? Now, if we look at the equation, the relative sign is governed by theta. And in that regard, these three singular points, these two outer guys, are qualitatively different to this one that occurs at the bounce itself. Right? Because you see, here, to the left of this singular point, theta is positive, and to the right, it's negative, and that's the same here. Whereas for the central singular point, you get the opposite happening. And what you'll find, if you restricted your solution, so if you set initial conditions here and tried to solve, what you'd find is finite solutions. If you just restricted attention to this portion between t is on this plot, 2 and minus 2 and 2, see. But if you want to look at the full theory, then you have problems. You can't avoid these singular points here. And you end up with solutions that just blow up.
Did you follow the Newtonian potential as well?
Sorry?
Did you follow the Newtonian potential through those points as well? Because it can be that zeta blows up even when the Newtonian potential is finite.
Sorry, what's the Newtonian potential?
Yeah, that's phi.
That's
phi. Presentation. Phi.
Sorry. Yes, so I've looked at that. So if you solve for phi and psi, they're fine. Yeah, but you'll find that this combination is not because of the denominator here.
Yeah, so that's a gauge problem.
So
that's the characteristic of a gauge problem. Zeta is the curvature in Kolmogorov gauge, and Kolmogorov gauge can become ill-defined if people are surrounded at zero.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying this is the same problem that was occurring in the last session.
Sorry.
You were the one arguing. you can't lie to me, Neo. I was there.
That wasn't me. Yes. I mean, people call it gauge invariant, but it's really gauge fixed. And so it's a curvature perturbation in a Kolmogorov gauge, but you can equally well just choose the perturbations in Newtonian gauge. They are finite. Then work in Newtonian gauge. clear why you can't go to Kerman Lagrange, because in order to go to Kerman Lagrange, you need to do a coordinate transformation from Newtonian gauge. And the shift in the potentials is proportional to P plus rho. So P plus rho is zero at that point. You actually can't get to Kerman Lagrange.
So you're saying this, there's no obstruction to calling this a physical problem?
Sorry, no, I'm saying it's not a physical problem.
Oh, it's not a physical problem.
Well, it could be, if it does.
Well, I think if there is a gauge in which all perturbation variables are finite, then in general it's possible to have an open set of gauges around that gauge, and then you say, well, there is a problem in those gauges.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I mean, yes, as far as the Newtonian gauge, but on the other hand, you could find that it's not a problem, you don't know that.
Sure. I think you need to look at the gauge that works and then look around it. See that there's an open set of gauges around it that work. Mm. But if gum moving gauge doesn't work, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm.
Don't make me do this in another gauge.
Sorry.
You
can
You've already done it
because you've got your phi and psi. So what I'm saying is your phi and psi are a complete description. Mm-hmm. And just forget about zeta. I mean, you could, or rather, that's what I want to say. Use phi and psi in the regions where zeta doesn't work. And in the regions where zeta does work, use zeta, and be happy. it's fine. I mean, you have a consistent propagation of the perturbations through these regions in the phi and psi variables. That means there is a good gauge. Hmm. I mean, what happens to phi and psi in the middle singularity?
That's fine too.
It's fine, everybody.
I was hoping I killed it. Okay.
And is this the instability we're talking about?
Yeah. So we just finished these calculations a week or two ago, so it's actually pretty good to get some comments from people in the room. I guess I'm right on time. So 1 minute? All right, well, I won't give any discussion.
Just to point out, exactly the same problems happen if you do the inflation calculations in detail, but when I have phi dots for the background scalar field, it's a zero.
Exactly.
Then zeta becomes a bad variable. So you go to the Newtonian potential and you see exactly the same kind of features.
Mm-hmm. So the potential is what you got. The Mukhanov, the cycle variable is what you got Newtonian
potential.
Okay,
it's gum moving. I call it Newtonian potential.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you can solve numerically for the vector and tensor perturbations and nothing goes wrong. So yeah, these are the questions that people ask for. I guess this might change in light of what Neil said. I guess more discussion is needed. Maybe we can talk afterwards. But yeah, so what new physics is responsible for the bounce? Torsion coupled to classical spinners. Might this new physics resolve the singularity for the perturbations as well as the background? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking. does this new physics have any observational signature? This is something we haven't really talked about. It'd be interesting to talk about, but possibly this preferred direction that's picked up by a mu is something you could detect. We haven't really discussed it. What physical principles underlie the theory beyond working to resolve the singularity? So the idea was just to use the minimal ingredients possible. Right. Does a consistent picture for cosmology require that both the background and perturbations are quantized? Doesn't seem like it. I mean, what I've done is all mathematically consistent, although maybe the classical spinner assumption was a little bit too stringent. Does the bounce or pre-bounce phase help in setting the initial conditions? Yes, in the sense that we can accommodate for ekpyrotic phases and this sort of thing. So, yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Hope it was perfectly timed.
free to ask questions now.
So you've shown the last bit for the perturbations for your simple potential, the
yeah.
E. Mm-hmm. Have you also done it for the ekphoric potential? Because otherwise, you'll still have the same problem with the NSR.
We think, well, okay, so in full disclosure, so this equation is much simpler in that case. We still get a prefactor in front of R dot, which has singularities in that case, but then we get some additional terms, and it's not entirely sure how to rearrange them so that we can write this in a closed form in terms of R. I mean, it's quite a complicated calculation. In full disclosure, so we think. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, as far as we're aware, this is going to be a problem generally. But no, we haven't looked at every single potential under the sun, and yeah.
So I'm wondering if there might be an instability towards Kasner-like behavior that I referred to before. So do your various conditions that you've imposed on the perturbations allow for that kind of perturbation? That kind of a solution. I think they do, but I couldn't follow, really.
As in, you're wondering whether anisotropies blow up or what?
Yes. Yeah, whether you could get...
Yeah, so you can...
Is the fact that the tensors don't blow up a sign that the anisotropy wouldn't you see that in the stability of the tensor mode?
I would think so, if they're completely free.
But this was a restricted set of tensors. Parity invariant perturbation, so there might be other perturbations that can still go unstable.
So I can tell you that so I don't have a complete answer for you, but I can tell you that in the parity invariant case, this term here in this equation of motion dies. So you get an equation for the scalar part of the anisotropic stress, which goes as minus, E dot equals minus 2h, sorry, sigma dot equals minus 2h sigma plus q, where q is given here. And I guess we could actually solve this equation to see how it goes. This is probably something sensible to do.
I'm confused about something. So, but you're saying that in spite of this singular behavior, you could still solve the equation because R, there are those solutions for R, you're saying?
Sorry?
In spite of the singular behavior for theta, there are still a...
The story is that you're not going to find a finite solution because of the character of these particular singularities.
So you could not just evolve beyond that.
Yeah.
So you could not go to a regime where there isn't this problem.
I thought you told us you did know that if you just, that phi behave normally, well,
so I might be misunderstanding. So phi behaves well.
So that proves you can solve the equation.
Yeah. Yeah. My understanding was, and I don't have a solid background in this, so I'm open to being wrong, but my understanding was that, you could have behavior of phi and q, which separately were fine, but, previously what I did was I solved for q and phi, and then I just plot them into this equation here, and I found two singular points, right? And then the idea was, my understanding was, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here, that R is a gauge invariant quantity, and so what I should do instead is obtain an equation of motion for R and then solve that.
So that's why I don't like this notation of gauge invariant.
Mm-hmm.
It's gauge fixed.
Yeah. So, but the problem is true.
The problem is that people interpret these things too much in biblical terms. They are only gauge fixed. None of the quantities are gauge invariant. They're all gauge fixed. Mm-hmm. Any gauge fixed quantity is, in a sense, gauge invariant. Because if it's a completely gauge fixed gauge, if it fixes all gauge degrees of freedom, then it is what it is in any gauge. But sometimes you can't get to that gauge. Mm-hmm.
But so your prescription moving forward. So in this, in
just find a gauge in which things are regular. That's it.
No, but a lot.
And you already have one. you've got Newtonian gauge, and things are regular on that gauge. So any gauge transformation around that gauge, where the coordinate transformations are not singular themselves, will probably give well-defined variables. So I think, you know, this is a gauge problem.
Right. I mean, but you're saying that in spite of this problem, you can evolve phi, and phi is perfectly fine.
Yes.
I mean, you could just evolve phi all the way to the end of the equation.
Yeah, you can evolve phi through and then convert to zeta where this works and just use zeta. Zeta is also for r.
There's
lots of advantages because it's conserved and so on. Mm-hmm. But in terms of getting through the singularities, phi is perfectly fine. You don't need to worry that zeta blows up here and there. Just don't use it in those regions.
That's what we do actually. Pre-inflationary dynamics, because phi dot vanishes in the pre-inflationary dynamics.
Exactly.
So then it blows up as a gradient.
And you see that people are throwing. Another way of saying that is that in order to go to Kolmogorov gauge, you need to do a time reparameterization if you're in some other gauge. And if you look at the shift in the time variable you need, it's proportional to p plus rho times some term violating the Kolmogorov gauge. Okay, so it is impossible. So if you try to find the shift in the time variable, it goes as 1 over p plus rho. It's exactly the second term of this equation. And so it's just saying you can't get to that gauge. That gauge is not singular for this problem. But you know, it's like in electrodynamics. Lorentz gauge is singular for some problems. I have an expanding shell of charge moving at the speed of light outwards. Lorentz gauge is terrible. Coulomb gauge is fine. So don't use Lorentz gauge, use Coulomb gauge. It's always true. I think it's true of any gauge theory. But no gauge is good for all problems. So in cosmology, people said, oh, there are gauge invariant variables. Let's always use that gauge. That's wrong. It's not that. There is no gauge. It's good for all problems.
But, then how can you prove that it's unstable?
You just find a gauge in which it's regular.
I mean,
that you've done it.
Wait.
No,
but that,
how do you prove that it's unstable?
Yeah, how do you show that?
How can
well,
you check all the
no,
gauges?
There's no problem. You do it in any gauge you want. If you find there... You know, you
well,
you physical.
Because only if you have an
unstable.
You
want
no.
Stability.
How can I prove that it's unstable?
Okay.
So,
you need to identify a physical phenomenon which detects that instability. Working in the metric variables will never tell you that. So you may need, you know, for example, you may calculate the Ricci scalar, something gauge invariant, like the Ricci scalar, or Weyl-Kovacic squared, or something. And then you could be sure. If it's infinite in one gauge, it's infinite in all gauges. But none of the metric variables have that property. You can't use them.
What as somebody was saying this morning, you could just look at a large spectrum end of inflation.
Yeah, exactly. So you can follow it all the way through and look at the asymptotic states. And if things blow up there, then there's a real problem. But if they blow up in the middle and you can find a gauge which avoids that, then you're fine.
But your statement is that if I solve numerically for phi so for the and psi, right? And I showed you that I could follow them through the bounce, they may grow a little bit but then come down again. That becomes much harder because then I need to look at the general equations of motion.
Sorry. so far we don't know, is that right? We don't know for sure what
if
it is.
What Neil is saying
it's
is correct.
Well, it's correct. It's totally correct. It's
you can just calculate the four-dimensional scalar curvature.
Right.
See if it is
infinite. Green squared, red squared, scalar curvature. Calculate those things through this block. But from what you say, I'm sure they will not
match. I think to prove that an instability is real is much harder because gauge gets mixed in. But to show that it's stable is not. I mean, if you get stable, I'm just exactly repeating what Neil said. If you get stability in a particular gauge, then it means all the physical fields are finite.
Mm-hmm.
So then, in any gauge, they'll look
fine. So you're saying
unless it's a singular gauge.
But just so I'm understanding, so the statement is that if everything remains finite. And regular, then there's no instability, but that quantity could be
right.
A quantity
that
isn't physical.
The point is, that quantity is quote-unquote gauge invariant, but it's not guaranteed to be finite in all physical situations where the space-time itself is finite. Right? I mean, like if you had a scalar field phi, phi is gauge invariant, but 1 over phi is also gauge invariant. But some places it blows up. I think that's a way of thinking about what's going on here. One should not jump to the conclusion that finiteness of the metric in the space-time requires finiteness of theta or r.
Okay, we are ridiculously late again, so we should probably stop here. And thanks, Shane, again.